Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. Aaron Thompson, an art historian at John Jay College in New York, will discuss the long history of dismantling statues. And the economist Jennifer Cohen will talk about the many gendered dimensions of the pandemic. A few words about the economic mess. On Thursday morning, the Labor Department reported that another 1.3 million people applied for unemployment benefits last week, bringing the total since the onset of the corona crisis to 50 million. That's almost a third the number of jobs that existed in February. That doesn't mean that a third of those jobs have disappeared. Some people are clearly cycling in and out of employment. But it is a measure of how badly damaged the job market is despite a couple of months of very partial recovery. Between regular unemployment insurance and the special pandemic program, almost 33 million people are drawing benefits. That's about five times its previous record. Wages and salaries fell from about 50% of personal income in February to 41% in April, before recovering to 44% in May. Fortunately, expanded unemployment benefits reversed a lot of that fall, rising from just 0.1% of total income in February, where it had been throughout 2019 and early 2020, to over 6% in May. That's over four times its previous high. Without those expanded benefits, tens of millions of people would be in dire shape. Those expanded benefits are slated to expire at the end of the month, and it's not clear whether Congress will extend them. Republicans would like them to expire to force people to go back to work. It's really hard to figure out what the strategy is behind that forced return to work. There's a bizarre false opposition that's been set up between fixing the economy and beating the pandemic. If people are sick and dying in large numbers, you have no economy. But according to the Washington Post, the Trump administration's strategy is just to wear us down. The goal is to convince Americans that they can live with the virus, the paper reported, and that Americans will grow numb to the escalating death toll and learn to accept tens of thousands of new cases a day. Meanwhile, a quarter of New York City renters haven't paid any rent since March, and that's with the expanded unemployment benefits. We're seeing similar numbers from elsewhere across the country. Take those expanded benefits away, and the human economic damage is going to multiply greatly. This is life in a collapsing empire. And now to my first guest. Aaron Thompson is the only professor of art crime in the U.S. She has degrees in art history and law and teaches at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She achieved some notoriety when on Twitter she advised a group of people who are pulling down a statue that chain works better than rope. Who says academics don't have practical skills? Aside from that gem, she has a lot to say about the social role of statues and the history of their destruction. Aaron Thompson. You come to this as a specialist in art crime. I believe you're, what, the only professor of art crime in academia or American academia? What kind of things have you studied before coming to fame around statues?
So I have a PhD in art history and a JD. And at first I started off being interested in the looting and smuggling of antiquities. But that's led me into a lot of directions. So I study things like museum heists and Nazi looted art. And forgery. I tweet about bad fake archaeology every day on Twitter, which is really fun. And I've also curated an exhibit of art made at Guantanamo by detainees and have thought a lot about what it means to deliberately destroy art, whether the Taliban destroying the Bamiyan Buddhas, ISIS in Syria and Iraq, or now with what it means to take down statues.
Guantanamo, there are two things that interest me there. One is the Guantanamo art. What was that like? What were the subjects? What were the style? And what do you learn by studying it?
I knew I had to curate this show because someone contacted me to say, I'm a lawyer. I represent a Guantanamo detainee. Would you like to display his art? And I thought, what in the world do you mean? People are at Guantanamo making art. So it turns out there's been an official art making program for years. All the art that's left as gifts for family members or lawyers has been approved by U.S. authorities to leave Guantanamo. There's no hidden messages. The subject matter is pretty neutral. It's pictures of flowers, of nature. Essentially, they told me of things that they missed. It's ugly there. You don't see anything beautiful. So they made windows to the worlds that they missed. So we did an exhibit at John Jay College. It's now going to travel around. Half of the artists in the show had been released without ever having been charged of anything. Only one of the other artists has been charged with anything. All of the others are detained indefinitely. And it was pretty funny to see people get very, very worked up about art made by horrible terrorists, quote unquote, that's, you know, a painting of a flower in a jar or something like that.
What was the outrage? That they were capable of human feeling and bordering on sentimentality, or that we're paying any attention to their art at all?
I think it's really the first. So even the government got angry. The Pentagon changed their policies based on the show, saying that no more art could leave Guantanamo and that they might burn art that remained. And I think it really was because they were so concentrated on, does this have a secret message, that they forgot the obvious message of the artwork, which is that it's made by human beings who deserve horrors, human rights, and especially to be tried in a timely manner.
Well, it's a reminder that people will make art under any circumstances. It's almost as if it's a fundamental human impulse.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that interests me, this is kind of random, but museum heists. What happened to the paintings when they're stolen from museums?
Yeah, I could teach you how to steal art from a museum, but then I'd have to catch you. Okay. It's actually incredibly easy to steal art from museums. Things have been used, like a pair of pliers to jimmy the lock on a back door, or someone stole the Scream once by stealing a ladder from a neighboring construction site and then breaking a window and reaching inside and grabbing it off the wall and then going back down the ladder. The problem is that if you steal something recognizable from display, what are you going to do with it? So most people who've been caught having stolen art on display from a museum are people who know how to steal things. So they know, in general, art is valuable. They spot a security flaw. They take something and figure out what to do with it later. And then they're like, oh, no, we can't sell this. So either they get caught immediately upon trying to sell it, or sometimes they read the papers and say, we've got to take the heat off. And so they either turn the work in, you know, phone an anonymous tip to the police station saying, go find this painting at a bus stop. Or sometimes, tragically, they destroy it to try and get rid of the evidence.
Are there ever commissions, like some plutocrat who says, I would like this painting for my wine cellar?
There's always rumors about that. You know, you hear the Dr. No theory. There have been criminal organizations found with stolen paintings, which we think is because, especially in Europe, there's a no questions asked a reward for return policy from a lot of insurance companies that cover museums. So it's a good way to put down security for a drug deal or something like that. And then if you need to, you can turn it in. But in the US, it doesn't really make sense. In a lot of the world, it doesn't make sense. And we've caught plenty of people you might expect to have stolen art, but they haven't. They've had plenty of art, but your average South American drug lord or dictator or whatever knows that art is good value, but stolen art, you're not ever going to be able to sell it. So who wants that?
So they prefer more traditional, like Rockefeller-style technique of just buying it?
Oh, yeah. Well, and the art market, let me tell you, is the last great remaining frontier for money laundering. It is incredibly easy to money launder on the contemporary art market. People are trying to bring that more into control, but it's really tough to figure out how to do that.
Why can't galleries and dealers be required to disclose the same way that other financial operators are?
Well, the answer to that question depends if you ask them or people who want them to disclose. So if you ask galleries and auction houses, they'll say, look, people sell art in embarrassing circumstances because they're getting divorced, because someone has died and they need to pay taxes, because they've declared bankruptcy, you know, nobody, and there's security issues. So if you say someone bought this multi-million dollar painting, then thieves might target their house or whatever. But these considerations of delicacy and safety don't apply in the same way in other financial transactions. So I think we can find ways around them.
Okay, and now on to statues. What is the function of a statue, a public statue? I mean, there is that Simon Schema article I sent you. I mean, he had an interesting formulation that it's meant in some ways to stop history or freeze history and to make a declaration to which there can be no appeal. What do you see the general function of public art like statues of the sort that are being torn down now?
So statues don't have nuances. They say this thing is good or that thing is bad. And a statue is an attempt to broadcast a view of history, which is also a view of present and the future, of this is the type of person that is going to be glorified, that has and will contribute to our nation. So to attack a statue is not just to attack a big hunk of bronze that nobody but pigeons seems to care about. It's to attack a view of the past that restricts whose voice is important in our nation.
And the particular statues we're focused on now, all these Confederate statues or statues memorializing Confederate heroes, were put up at specific points in history, right? What motivated their erection?
Yeah, I see a lot of people saying, well, it's too bad that we're tearing down these historical monuments, as if we're losing information about the past or some sort of archaeological information. But many people are surprised to learn that most of the Confederate monuments that are being protested today are very recent. They were, the bulk of them, erected in the 1960s under Jim Crow, very much as messages to populations of potential Black voters to say, look, you're not welcome here in our present or our future. And many of these monuments also came along with laws to protect them, to prevent them from being protested and taken down. So in many southern states, it's actually against the law for even a municipality to remove or modify a Confederate monument.
You mean there's state laws that to prevent towns from taking them down?
Yes. Yeah, so outside of Alabama, a majority Black community covered a Confederate monument with plywood and a tarp, and were sued by the state attorney general, who said, that's against the law. You can't mess with this statement about who you really are, essentially.
And what about something like Monument Avenue in Richmond? Do you know anything about the history of that?
Yeah, so that is very interesting because it shows a potential response to statues. So some people say, well, look, forget all this violence against statues that are already up. Let's just add some more statues. Let's diversify, sort of affirmative action for statues, more or less. So Monument Avenue features a lot of Confederate-related characters, all white men, except for they've added fairly recently a statue of Arthur Ashe, an African-American tennis champion. And I think the heavy protests against the other statues in Monument Avenue has shown that that's not good enough. You can't just add more representative statues. You have to stop the pain of statues that are already up.
Well, I guess there are people who defend the statues by saying, well, they're history lessons and conversation pieces, and taking them down will prevent us from having those considerations. What do you say to that?
I've seen this a lot, too. And, you know, when I teach history, I don't have to carry around statues to do so.
They are bulky, not very portable.
I mean, it's a real pain when you have to make a whole new statue to teach a lesson. No, I mean, people say this, but everybody who walks past statues knows that they become part of the street furniture. You don't really even see them, except if they hold a sort of painful message to you. So don't worry. You know, we remember who historical figures are without having to have them over life-size in our public squares.
I'm speaking with America's only professor of art crime, Aaron Thompson. I don't know if you saw it, but Lucian Truscott IV, who is a direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson, many great-grandfathers. I can't remember how many greats have to be placed in front of grandfather, but quite a few. But he had a piece in the New York Times on Tuesday in which he said, the Jefferson Memorial should be taken down. It serves no purpose. Whereas Monticello, Jefferson's house in Charlottesville, is a museum where actually that kind of historical conversation goes on. And they really explore the contributions of the slaves to the life of Monticello and the physical presence of Monticello. Seems like an interesting distinction there that, you know, a museum of the sort that Monticello is actually can be the site of those historical conversations where a monument like the Jefferson Memorial is meant to stop them.
Well, I think it depends on how you use monuments at all. We can think of this putting paints and adding messages and projections and even breaking of statues as using them to have a conversation about the history of our country. And at the same time, you can't be too optimistic. So there is a very interesting field of scholarship on contentious heritage. And people have done studies on what visitors actually get out of places where the people in charge of that place have attempted to have a conversation about negative aspects of heritage. And it turns out that if you don't want to know about the realities of slavery when you visit a plantation, you will almost literally be blind to all the signage and the attempts to have that conversation. People see what they want to see.
Every time I hear that, it always depresses me as a devotee of rationality, but I guess this is not what most people experience. The removal of statues has a long, long history, right? I mean, this goes way, way back. Just review some of the highlights in the destruction of statuary.
Well, it makes sense that as long as we've been making statues, we've been tearing them down when we're a little sick of the person they're representing, because statues are lifelike. Even today, there's the social psychology and neuroscience studies showing that we feel uncomfortable inflicting harm onto more and more lifelike things. So where you can bounce a ball up and down, no problem. If you're a kid and you're given a puppy-shaped stuffed animal, you start to feel uncomfortable throwing it down on the ground. So from the beginning of art making, statues, representations of the human body have held a special power. And we often connect the statue with the person it represents. So that's the idea behind the Roman emperors sending thousands of portrait statues of themselves around the empire to keep an eye on everybody. That's the idea behind ancient Near Eastern kings attacking physically the statues of the people they have defeated and poking out their eyes and carving off their ears to humiliate the kings that they have conquered the territory of, even if that king had been dead for thousands of years. Or even think of that about the Egyptians putting statues of themselves in their tombs, so just in case their body gets messed with, their spirit can inhabit the statue. So there's a real deep connection in human experience between a person and a statue representing them. So it's really no wonder that if you can't attack that person, the next best thing is attacking that statue.
Now, there are people who are saying that the destruction of these Confederate statues and such, and it's not just, it's moved beyond Confederates to, you know, going after Ulysses Grant and George Washington, but that this is analogous to what the Taliban did, blowing up statues, and that people who do these things are sort of Philistines and reactionary cretins, very much like the way people view the Taliban. What do you say to that?
I think that to make that easy equivalent is to misunderstand both what's happening today and what the Taliban did. So Taliban and the Islamic State both very publicly destroyed statues, but they also were saying that they were against Islam, but they were hypocritical because they destroyed the things they couldn't sell. And then they looted antiquities, stole them from museums, and sold the other ones to make a big profit to fund their activities. And the statues that they destroyed, or the heritage that they destroyed, wasn't a threat to them. You know, this Taliban blowing up the Bamiyan Buddhas, no one was actually worshiping Buddha in Afghanistan at the time. Instead, what it was a message that if you dare to think differently about religion than what the official Taliban line was, that you too would be crushed. So these were acts of intimidation. These were acts of closing in on visions of the present and the future to the one line that would be held. What we see with attacks on statues today are, I think, attempts to address the pain of the past in order to work towards a more peaceful future. And I also like to point out that, you know, we discussed earlier these laws protecting these statues, that many of these statues that are being protested or taken down today had been peacefully protested for years, for decades, sometimes before they even went up. And those people's protests were never given a venue, were never attended to. So it's not very surprising if you don't provide any way for peaceful resolution that you're going to see people taking matters into their own hands.
I believe Tucker Carlson accused you of damaging humanity's shared heritage or something like that. How do you plead?
He called me a nihilist who commands mobs.
And, oh, congratulations.
And I got to say, my kids are the only nihilists I know, and they laugh at the idea that I could command them to, you know, take a bath even. Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of concepts of shared heritage as something that we have to preserve it all. We can never discard any of it. And that's just not how it works. We throw things away all of the time. And statues are this interesting case. Everybody has the experience of watching something, a television show, a movie from their youth or music they used to love and thinking, oh, that did not age well. You know, that joke, that depiction of a character, ugh, problematic. But those things, those features of culture, of our national conception of things, those kind of fade away, you know. But statues, unfortunately or fortunately, don't fade away. They're there. So we have to make a deliberate decision about what we're going to do with them.
And, of course, you got a lot of criticism for advising people how to tear down statues more effectively. What was your advice on how to do it properly?
Well, I think I was making more of a joke than actually offering any advice. Turns out people don't really need advice. It's pretty obvious as to principles. I saw a tweet of protesters from the American Indian Movement tying ropes around a statue of Columbus in Minnesota and pulling on it. And I tweeted, you know, as a professor who studies the deliberate destruction of heritage, I should just have to say, use chains instead of rope and it'll go faster. But I'm not advocating for any of that. I mean, people have gotten seriously injured. So, and on the other side too, there's been at least one murder from someone trying to defend a statue from being taken down, shot a protester. I think this is not an ideal way of going about things at all. But we do need to have these conversations and these debates about who should represent us as a nation.
Yeah, I mean, the act of tearing these things down has elevated the conversation to a new level. I mean, if we're just all politely having discourse, we probably would not have made the progress we have.
We've had that polite discourse for decades, and nothing really has happened.
So what should be done with, you know, Columbus and Jeb Stuart and all these characters? What do you think the proper way to go about dealing with these unwelcome reminders of our hideous past?
Well, you know, I wish I were the king of the universe and could say yes, no, yes, no. But I don't have a, you know, flip chart of which statues should be allowed or who should be up. I think I'm actually a little distrustful of the notion of statues per se, because as I said before, they are without nuance. It's hard to have a conversation about...
You mean historical statues, not Michelangelo?
Oh, yeah, no. honorific statues. People can make whatever statues they want, but the idea of putting something up in the, you know, courthouse square is everyone should be like X. Well, that's a whole lot of burden on X's shoulders.
So, I mean, what kind of feelings did you have seeing these things coming down, given your academic background and studying this sort of thing?
I think it's very surprising as an art historian. I feel like I talk about art to bored students all the time, and suddenly to see people get all worked up about art is pretty exciting. Yeah, this is the way I feel about it, too.
Yeah, so they're not just dead objects there, are they?
No, very much not. And also, I think that this is just an initial step, because, you know, the American Natural History Museum just took down or announced that it would be taking down its statue of Roosevelt from outside on its steps. And I think, well, what about the stuff inside the museum too? There are so many objects looted, often violently, from colonized countries or demanded back in repatriation, or sacred objects that source communities say shouldn't be displayed. You know, we've got a lot of talking about to do about justice, social justice, racial justice, and the art world in general.
That was Aaron Thompson, a professor at John Jay College who specializes in art crime. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Y'all.
That was some of End the Washington Monument, Blink's Goodnight by the DC band Q and Not U from 20 years ago. Next, Gendering the Corona Crisis. In its Thursday print edition, the New York Times reported that a San Diego woman, Drisana Rios, sued her former employer, Hub International, a global insurance brokerage, for gender discrimination and wrongful termination. Her boss complained that clients could hear sounds of her children in the background on phone calls as she was working from home. Rios said that she'd been working harder than she ever had in her life trying to juggle her job and taking care of two young children. She says she met all her deadlines, but her boss found all the childish sounds to be unprofessional, and he urged her to take care of your kids' situation and your time management issues. This is, of course, a pending lawsuit, and we don't know the employer's side of the story, but her former supervisor didn't respond to requests for comment from the Times. The story quotes a study by a USC-based think tank showing that in two-parent households, 44% of women said they alone provided childcare in the household in early April, compared with 14% of men, for a gender disparity of over 3-1. That's not the only aspect of the crisis in which women are getting the short end of the stick. There's also women's disproportionate presence in the healthcare field, a site of particular stress these days. Here with more is Jennifer Cohen. Cohen is a professor of global and intercultural studies at Miami University in Ohio and a researcher at the Reproductive Health and HIV Institute at the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa. She was on this program back in January 2018 to give an overview of feminist economics. Jennifer Cohen. This pandemic is clarifying an awful lot of things about political economy at once. So what is it that the pandemic is revealing about the nature of gendered labor and social relations?
One of the things is how important gender is in the healthcare system itself, in terms of healthcare workers and healthcare system fragility. So what we're seeing is that the health of healthcare workers is really foundational to communities, to societies, to households, to everyone. I mean, we can't actually have a society without having healthy healthcare workers. So in terms of that, women are 60% of healthcare workers in the U.S. So women are doing a lot of the healthcare work around the pandemic, in addition to increased workloads at home, having to do with childcare and education and all of that, while the schools have been closed.
What do we know about, from time use surveys and that sort of thing, about the division of gendered labor, or gender division of labor, rather, in normal times? And what do you suppose the pandemic is doing to that?
In usual times, you know, of course, they still show that women do more work than men. And where there's been narrowing, it's been partly because women have been doing less household work in terms of time use, although men have done a little bit more as well. What's happening now, I mean, anecdotally, I can say from people in academia that people are largely saying it's just impossible to work and have children right now. So, I mean, that's a huge thing. One of the other things in thinking about time use is to think about households that have women without a partner, right? So if you're a single parent and you've got childcare to do and ostensibly a real, you know, this other job that you're supposed to really be doing at home now, there's a fundamental conflict between what people are able to do with their time. And you can't be doing literally two actually distinct things at once. So in terms of gendered relations between men and women, I think you have seen some breakdown of some barriers for men, because the household has taken this new role through Zoom where it's become more visible. But a lot of the work is still very clearly falling on women. And, you know, there are all kinds of stories of women working in the bathroom with the door closed because it's the only space that they can get to themselves and be uninterrupted.
Yeah, I have a 14-year-old. I can't imagine what people who have young children are doing in this environment. It's just unimaginably burdensome. But I saw an exchange between two women on Twitter, I believe both journalists, the other day. One said, they said that, "I don't feel like I'm working from home. I feel like I'm sleeping at the office."
Yeah, that seems right. I mean, this kind of overlap of jobs now, I mean, there's really no work-life separation. Although one of the things I would say, and I may come back to you later about the nurses, is that the idea that there's something called work-life balance is sort of bizarre anyway under any conditions because of the way that people's lives are shaped by their jobs anyway to begin with.
You see that sort of thing in the Wall Street Journal and such, but, you know, what is being perverted by that phrase?
Of work-life balance?
Yeah.
I mean, the expectation that there's some kind of actual separation, right? I mean, this is reifying some separate spheres kinds of arguments from old feminist work from the 70s. very clearly now we have a geographic merging of these two potential spaces when people are working at home and doing all of the social reproduction work at home. But in practice, everyone's lives outside of work is continuously always shaped by what they're doing when they're doing paid work. So, for example, with the nurses, is the shift schedule. You know, if you're working a 12-hour shift, that impacts everything about how you organize your life. And that's not just nurses. It's just that that one is unusual in contrast to the more usual thing that we think of as like a 9-to-5 or now 5 to whenever you go to sleep.
Is the phrase kind of a holdover from a very rigidly gendered world in which, you know, men did the work outside and women did the work at home?
I think it's from when women started doing paid work and work-life balance became this thing where, you know, you're supposed to be superwoman and have it all. Like, having it all was to be able to have work-life balance so that you were able to have a life that was somehow imaginarily distinct from your work.
And, of course, now that for a large portion of the workforce, that distinction has collapsed.
Absolutely.
And we just can't really adapt to it very well, can we?
The technology is there to make it possible in the same way that the technology has become a sort of like colonizing force in some of the leisure activities that people do. So it makes it possible, and it makes it possible to do it nonstop all the time.
What do you mean by the technology? Is that it just the work part, the paid work part, has taken over life entirely?
I'm thinking about Zoom specifically and all of the Zoom meetings that bring. We're all in our houses doing, many of us are in our houses doing paid work already, but that's opening a window into the household where now we're doing both paid and unpaid work.
And what would be a better way of doing this, more humane way of doing this?
I mean, obviously a more equitable distribution of unpaid labor in the household would be preferable, but still I'll go back to this question of single moms and, you know, what do you do about that, especially when schools are out, and then especially when, you know, next school year, we're talking here about having this hybrid school thing where the kids are in school 2 days a week and then 3 days a week the next week or something. You know, I mean, then it's like how you manage childcare while you're supposed to be actually physically going to campus now at this point. It's just implausible. So, I mean, clearly childcare is a huge, huge issue. That's one of the most fundamental things. And addressing that would be a more humane thing under a pandemic. It's not necessarily clear exactly how we could do that.
Could we achieve a more equitable distribution of household labor with a very nuclear family kind of model that we live under now? Or would we need much more socialization of household functions, Alexandra Cullen-Tai style, for that to work?
Having more socialized versions of lots of household things would be certainly preferable. There's no need for families or households to be responsible for the set of things that they're responsible for producing. You know, I mean, this is just a socially contingent model that we've ended up through historical processes with. But there's nothing natural about that. Those things can very easily be moved out of the household. In some sense, we, you know, public schools sort of were that, you know, and it's become clear, even though most people didn't talk about public school in that way, it's become clear that that's part of the function of schools was to liberate, I can't come up with the right word, to emancipate, I guess, is the adults to go and do wage labor.
That's a curious form of emancipation.
Yeah, I'm using it kind of ironically there, but it's like the double freedom, right? It's Marx's double freedom.
What kind of socialization, aside from public schools, I mean, what other things do you have in mind that would socialize some of these burdens?
All kinds of childcare. I mean, not just public schools, but all kinds of childcare before school and after school. Like, one of the major issues, again, with the nurses, with the shift work, is that they have 14-hour work days, including their commute. There's no childcare available outside of regular hours unless they, like, tag together different childcare providers. And there's no need for that. I mean, the state should be providing that, especially now that it's very clear that women are the essential workers. And like I said, this is an important thing for healthcare system capacity. So all versions of childcare, there are all kinds of other potentially socializable things, though. Basic medical care could be made more readily available. Obviously, for people who have housing insecurity, that should be readily available. It's arguable that all of the basic necessities should be socially available, that should be part of a living humanely in society.
Okay, and now on to the healthcare situation. You spent a lot of time studying nurses in South Africa, particularly in the midst of the HIV crisis. There are some parallels between HIV and corona, I guess. What did you discover studying these nurses? I mean, what kinds of stresses were there on their lives, and what impossible things are they trying to balance?
One of the important things to think about is not just with COVID, but with HIV, like nurses' health doesn't start there. Nurses' health starts with gendered and racialized work in the household. So what I did was qualitative work there. I did interviews with 71 nurses in Johannesburg in a city hospital. And there, like here, most nurses are women, which means that they bear disproportionate responsibility for the work of social reproduction. And what was interesting was when we sat down to do the interviews, a really surprising number of nurses started crying when I asked how they were. Right? They, a lot of them would respond with like, you know, it's my son's birthday, or, you know, and I'm looking forward to dinner or whatever. But I'd be like, but how are you? And really an alarming number of people just started crying and were sort of like, no one's asked me how I'm doing, in memory pretty much. So that was a beginning hint to this sort of universal chronic stress that women nurses in South Africa were under. What's interesting about that stress is that it's perceived by the nurses and by hospitals and by unions to be, if it's related to the household, then it's privatized, right? It's private stress. But when you have this stress that's actually a function of the occupation, if it's a function of shift work, then it's an occupational problem. So a lot of the stress that nurses were under that had the appearance of being as if it's just childcare was not just childcare. It's gender norms that dictate that women are responsible for childcare, not just for caregiving, but materially also, and their shift work schedule that made childcare virtually impossible. So there are a number of nurses who had children being raised in other households, for example, because it was just impossible to reconcile those duties.
Now, South Africa is a relatively poor country compared to the United States, although the United States sometimes has social indicators that don't look like we're rich countries either. How transferable is what you discovered in South Africa to the American context?
So the gender norms there are stricter to some degree, but the carryover between the format of the work being shift work and gendered responsibilities for care, a lot of that does transfer over to here. And I think I'm trying to get some funding to do some more research on this in the US, but where you have gender norms that require women to do this kind of unpaid work, and where women are far more likely than men to end up being a single parent with children, these things that appear to be conflicts and appear to be like private household issues are issues across the board. When I started this project, one of the questions someone asked me was like, how is this going to be different for nurses than for other women who are in paid work? And that's one of the ways, is that the shift work makes it even more difficult to manage what is already difficult for women who are working in usual hours and now in all hours.
I'm speaking with the economist Jennifer Cohen. Nursing is gendered somewhat as care work, and you know, it's supposed to be natural for women to take on care work. How does this play into it?
So in the U.S., 60% of healthcare workers, period, are women, including nurses and home health aides and things like that. So women are responsible for the work of social reproduction that's unpaid, and then women are the ones that do this kind of feminized work, often not solely women, but often. And so you have, like I said, the health system really is depending on women's health then. So if women are under all the stress, if they're under, you know, universal chronic stress, then there's some fragility in the healthcare system itself. So you've got public health relying on the healthcare system, which relies really fundamentally on nurses' continued participation in the healthcare system. So when nurses get sick, they both increase demand for care and reduce supply. And that holds whether they're sick with COVID or HIV or, you know, just overwork and burnout.
Yeah, it does seem that nurses are particularly susceptible to burnout. I remember when I used to work at a medical library long ago, it was a very common topic in the nursing journals. I guess this is what it is. It's the combination of on-the-job stress, but then all this hidden off-the-job stress as well.
Exactly. So one of the things that's interesting about that is it's hidden, but it's a function of the job also. And so the nurses distinguished between this when we were doing the interviews and said this, they talked about the what they perceived to be home-based stress as bad stress in contrast to the stress that they expect as part of the job. So the bad stress that really wore on them were stressors that appeared to be coming from the household, but in fact are coming from the household in relation to conditions of work.
Caring for sick people is going to be stressful no matter what the circumstances. But the off-the-job stuff, what could we do for that? Is there something particular for nurses, or just general approach to reducing this gendered exploitation?
Shifting gender norms, of course, would be the ideal. Until something like that is feasible or in the works, and maybe the pandemic will have some impacts there, who knows. But in lieu of that, having universally available childcare 24 hours a day to accommodate for whatever schedules people are working would be a significant reduction in stress, because managing that and then trying to go, if your kids are being raised somewhere else, trying to go and visit them, you know, being a single parent, other ones had like their kids are being raised by their sister, but it's a 3-hour trip to get out there. So they take one of their days off from the week to go out to visit their children. And some of them talked about going out and feeling like while they were visiting, they needed to take some of the household labor off of their sister or mom, for example. So they're still doing a lot more of that work. So childcare is definitely a big one for shift work. Better public transportation would be another one, because that also, the usage of that is gendered. The apartheid geography in South Africa is also part of that in South Africa, but that holds for the U.S. also.
And then finally, you have a little paper about the incompatibility of capitalism and public health, which this pandemic is revealing. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about how we have like a profit-seeking imperative and how that can get in the way of what requirements are for public health. So another paper I'm working on is on price gouging. So there you see this, you know, this is the price gouging that happened around the hand sanitizer. But this happens with the N95 masks also, the respirators. So what you see is people buying these up, and then we have a shortage of PPE, personal protective equipment, which has both physical and mental health impacts on healthcare workers, because if they don't feel protected, then that adds to their stress. So that paper is basically focusing on how capitalism incentivizes certain behaviors or makes structurally necessary certain pursuits. So the other one is on entrepreneurialism, makes necessary certain pursuits that get in, that really impede access to necessities for healthcare workers, because they're inputs to public health, and healthcare workers themselves are inputs to public health. So anything that makes them, you know, makes it more difficult for them to obtain the necessities for them to do their job well, compromises public health.
You point out, though, that like these price gougers, the people who tried to corner the market in hand sanitizer or masks, or even some character like Martin Shkreli, these people are perceived as outliers, jerks, bad apples, whatever. But how different are they from the normal rest of the system?
They're not. What capitalism does is incentivize this, whether you want to think about it as behavior or as structurally necessary from a more Marxist perspective. This is a very similar thing. What's different from a Marxist perspective is that if you think about there being injustice through exploitation in the sphere of production, the injustice that's happening in price gouging is in the sphere of circulation. And whether that's exploitation or not depends on how you want to conceptualize that. But, you know, that's the difference. It's in the sphere of circulation. What's interesting about that is that then you get this big backlash from people. So there's a story about a child who is selling squirts of hand sanitizer for 50 pence, who's in the UK, to students. And he got sent home from school. And you have this long list of congratulatory, he's a genius things on this Facebook post that his mom made. But when you see that actually happen with people who are being, quote, entrepreneurial, like the brothers in Tennessee that got 17,000 bottles of hand sanitizer, but also had masks and things, people almost universally condemn that. So you have this strange cognitive dissonance between having entrepreneurial behavior be laudable under more usual conditions, and being a subject of criticism outside of the usual conditions. And I think the reason for that is because when it's in the sphere of circulation, it's demystified, right? That injustice is demystified in a way that in the sphere of production, the employment relation sort of hides the exploitation through, you know, labor market contracts.
Yeah, it looks like free exchange in the employment relation, whereas the criminality of this gets foregrounded when it's somebody like selling squirts of hand sanitizer for 50p. But then you have a drug company like Gilead pricing remdesivir, which was developed mostly with public funds, $3,000, $4,000 a course of therapy, even though they really didn't put much money into developing the thing. So how would you characterize that?
I partly want to call it distortions, but I mean, it's very clear that there's no like just distortions in a market, because if there's nothing there that it makes that a market determined price, right? So the system that we have of patents in medical research, and you think about insulin and EpiPens, those issues are built into the way that we manage intellectual property, which as state subsidized research should be socially owned. Right? So it shouldn't be up to private companies to establish prices on things like that, especially when there's no even pretense of it being some kind of neutral objective price determined in markets by buyers and sellers. It's just clearly the price is just created.
So is there any hope that this crisis will further this kind of analysis and maybe a political agenda associated with it? Do you have any reason to think that something better might come out of this, or are we just like on the road to perdition?
I really hope that something better comes out of it. All of these things that we keep talking about the revelatory role of the pandemic, I mean, it really has revealed a sort of infinite number of social fractures and inequalities in ways that people didn't, a lot of people didn't believe were there before. And I'm cautiously optimistic that there might be some recognition of that and some grappling with it. Certainly, I think that that is related to some of the Black Lives Matter protests that have been happening. And health disparities by race are huge in the U.S. So cautiously optimistic, but with the nurses thing, if gender norms don't change and women are still responsible for that work, then it's unclear without, massive state investment how we would end up with something that would substantially change either their material conditions or their lived experiences.
Well, of course, the first step is recognizing it, and it's kind of hard to get that done even.
It is. One way that we will certainly see that, though, is through healthcare workers getting sick. So, all the capacity constraints that people have been talking about is ICU beds and ventilators. No one has talked about the capacity of healthcare workers to manage stress as, a critical component of healthcare system capacity. But like I said, when they get sick, you have a decrease in supply and an increase in demand. When you have healthcare workers pass away, you have a sort of permanent reduction in supply subject to whatever rate people are graduating from schools as healthcare workers. So there's already a massive shortage among nurses. So I think that that's going to be something to come to grips with that will be in most countries, because the nursing shortage is in most countries. So one of the things I think could be an actually very good potential public policy outcome that would prepare the countries better for future pandemics and aging populations and various other issues would be investing in educating people as healthcare workers, especially now where we're going to have we have massive unemployment. Not everyone is going to go back to those jobs. Reskilling people into healthcare work jobs, one of the things that can't be replaced with technology when it's the in-person kind of work, seems like a really good investment in the future, especially considering that this is unlikely to be the last one of the pandemics that we'll see.
I was Jennifer Cohen, professor of global and intercultural studies at Miami University in Ohio, and a researcher at the Reproductive Health and HIV Institute, University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. As regular listeners probably know, I'm a big fan of the Mekons, a band that's been around for over four decades and is still putting out great music. Last month, they released a new album on Bandcamp, Exquisite. I played one song from it in last week's show. Here's another, West York's Ballad. Till next week, bye.
Thoughts that should stay hidden, walking, treading.